Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
The reliably colourful Formula One team owner Eddie Jordan, he died this year at the age of 76. The Sing Street boy, he became a brazen entrepreneur, deal maker and a musician as well. He was very enthusiastic about his music. His impact though on F1 was enormous. He brought all the crack and the colour. What memories in that golden era of his. His friend Keith O'Loughlin, he's written this lovely biography. It's called Eddie Jordan, Full Throttle, which is the only name you could give. And Eddie's wife, another Dubliner, she's on the line from London. Marie Jordan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Oliver. Good morning.
I imagine the last couple of months have been very difficult for you and you have our sympathies.
Eddie, thank you, yes.
It was very tough. He suffered from cancer and he... How did he navigate his illness? How did you cope?
Well, he'd had cancer. He'd had a melanoma about 2 years previously in the back of his calf.
Right.
And that they took two goes to remove. It was quite a big operation, the second one. And he was supposed to lie in bed with his head above his heart for about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm afraid Eddie was up and on a bike within three.
Really, really?
And by 8 weeks, he had done, and the eighth week, he did the Argus. Well, it's not the Argus anymore, but a huge bike ride in Cape Town covering 120K and finished in just over 4 hours or something. So I'm afraid he had, I think, more or less burnt himself out. Never really fully got over that. And by the time this next cancer had arrived, he really hadn't got much, you know, the battery was empty at that stage and there wasn't much to fight it. So, you know, he'd good days, bad days, and then it just got slowly worse. And yeah, I mean, he was strong during it. He was mentally extremely strong.
Yeah.
So, you know, gave it his all, but there was really nothing left. So it was his time, best way to look at it.
And he was working away, wasn't he, right to the end? I mean,
he did. He did that the major deal for Adrian Newey through his illness. And in fact, the 2 days after he'd had his prostate removed, he flew out to Monaco to interview Adrian on stage in Monaco.
Extraordinary.
You know, extraordinary. But that in the end doesn't help, that kind of thing.
But this was the man you knew all your life. How did you meet Eddie?
Oh, that was originally through an ex-boyfriend of mine. That was the very first time I met him. And then I met him. We went to see a group playing on a Sunday evening at about 5 o'clock. And I bumped into him again, but he was with a girlfriend at that stage. I mean, there's quite a story to it. And then I was heading out with my sister to Greece for a couple of days.
Yeah.
And we were at the airport and we were delayed. The only people in the airport. And he arrived in. He had a BBC card or something like that. And he arrived in, oh, probably an RTE card, I should say. And he arrived in to see me, saying that he was going to interview me or something. And wouldn't leave until I'd agreed to meet him again.
This was another deal he was doing. You were there.
This was definitely, I wasn't getting away easily. Yes.
That's late 70s and you get married in Terenure.
Yeah, we got married in Terenure in 79, yeah. But then we went straight off to, he was taking gap year from the bank,
yeah,
to race, carry his own racing in Silverstone. So we left Ireland by February.
Wow. It's a whirlwind, isn't it? Because you have four children together. You seem to be traveling all around the world throughout their upbringing and your lives together.
Yeah, and yet Eddie was not what I would call a real traveller. He did travel a lot, mm-hmm, but he'd have no interest in really in, you know, going around the next corner to see what might be there. Or I remember arriving in New York, I'd never been before, and I'm kind of up and ready to go at 7:30, and Eddie's thinking, oh, I'll just, you know, read the paper and have a cup of coffee. And his idea of seeing New York was to go out and have a cup of coffee somewhere.
That was it.
Yeah, that was and I'm the opposite. I like to see what's going on and who's there and what's going around the next corner.
You like to stroll around, take it handy. Perfect mix.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The world came to know him as an extraordinary risk taker. He creates his own team to take on the big guns. I mean, that's mad enough. Discovers Michael Schumacher, Eddie Irvine, gives Damon Hill the breakthrough win. But what was he to you?
Well, a menace and mischievous and all that.
I mean,
yeah. But he didn't really carry that into the home. I mean, he was always mischievous, but he was fairly quiet at home. That was his downtime, I suppose,
wow,
and grounding. I mean, Eddie had, we realise now, very extreme attention deficit disorder. So when you learn about the issues that they have, you understand exactly what made them tick. But beyond that, you didn't get very far. Like I said, somebody's asking me the other day about Formula One, and I just remember him walking in the door one day and saying, basically, I'm going into Formula One. And that was it. I mean, he'd obviously be thinking about it. He would often sit and think. In fact, that was his thing. He'd either be on the phone or he'd be sitting quietly thinking. And you never really knew. He'd never tell you what he was thinking about. He didn't discuss those kind of things. And he'd just come out. And the same if he'd a major problem, he'd rant and rave for about 5 minutes and then he'd go off and think. And then he'd come back with a solution. It was always about he'd have the solution, getting the solution. And I often think he worked better with his back against, you know, in trouble. Wow. And finding solutions. And he'd do things like, if he'd a sponsor and he goes to the sponsor with one way of approaching sponsorship and they'd say no, he'd be back there the next week with a different style of approach. Right. And if they didn't agree to that, he'd go back again with an even different one until he'd beaten them down.
There was just never was going to accept
never
no.
Give up.
He didn't seem to have, it sounds like he never lived with uncertainty. He was certain about what he was doing. There was no tortured decision making.
Yes, that's actually almost in a way a part of attention deficit disorder as well. It's being very direct about what they want to do and how they're going to do it and staying on that line. And if it's off the line, they're bored, they're not interested. They need to move in what they're interested in.
I'm amazed because in his job in Bank of Ireland, he's selling cars on the side. People come in looking for a car loan. He's trying to sell them a car. He's spotting the opportunities. And you bring that right up to his heyday, where he literally creates a new colour, doesn't he, for the Jordan yellow. I think he was at one point painted green with a deal with the tourist board from Ireland. And tell us about this story to do with the sponsors and the colours.
Well, it also came about through television and the colour for the car. In fact, to make the car kind of, I'm not going to say sparkle, it didn't sparkle, to make the car and the yellow look good on TV, they actually put a shine into it.
Wow.
So it's like a flex into it, and they use things like that. But you're talking about the DHL one, where he went to them for sponsorship, and they were white and white and red, I think it was, wasn't it? And they had agreed to sponsor but the car to be white, so he went back to Benson Hedges and they said there's no way we're yellow, we're staying on that. And then he went back to DHL and he had a board with turny pages, and he showed them, you know, three white vans, and then he puts in the next page, two white vans and one yellow van, saying, well, which one stands out? And he explained it all. He'd all done. And he explained to them that, you know, white was kind of similar colors to other of their businesses similar to them.
Yes.
And he eventually got them to change to yellow. And they, I suppose, then had to create a color for them as well. And it kind of came about through that.
So he changes the colour of DHL's branding worldwide, and they stick to it. And he he's broken the golden rule of marketing, isn't it? Don't change the colour, but he did.
It's white a colour. That's the other thing. You know?
That's good. And he kept receiving royalties. Is that true for this idea of his?
Yes.
So he won. In every direction.
There was always a little kind of piece at the end. He always used to say, you can't beat the bit you steal. And that would have been that bit, that extra little bit that would give him the bit of dopamine for the day, I suppose.
Yeah. There's a great bit from the London Times obituary earlier in the year where he admits to accepting a £40 million investment from a banker. He says this guy hadn't a clue. Then Eddie repurchases the 40% share from the bank for a fraction of the value and then resells it to another bank. This was his entertainment.
That was his whole his whole life was about deals and doing deals, and it didn't matter whether it was a penny, 20p, thousands. It didn't matter. He just liked getting the deal and feeling that he had done his best and basically won over. Yeah.
Pat from Oak Gerard in the west of Ireland is in touch with us, talking about these days. Hello to you and condolences as well. He says he knew Eddie Jordan for yonks. He sold me a cylinder head for an Alfa Romeo over the bank counter once. He was a great character.
The other one that he did was he was up north and he was in the back roads speeding, and I think it'd be BMW, probably one of the ones for sale. And he was flying along, police, ER, pulled in. So the policeman then starts to walk around the car and says, yeah, that's a fine car you've got and all that. Mm-hmm. The policeman actually buys the car. I mean, yeah.
I mean, there's nobody. That is a one-off. There is nobody that can pull that off.
There's loads of stories like that. You keep hearing new ones.
He didn't have a dull day, this man.
No.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, no, no, he couldn't. That was the other thing. So people with attention deficit disorder need to get dopamine hits.
Right.
So they'll cause a stir just for that. So he'd go in and cause an absolute chaos somewhere, have an absolute strop at something. And then he'd walk away with a smile on his face saying, that was great. And he'd be lifted, or he'd do the opposite. There'd be the excitement one, the big entrance and way and all that. Yeah. So there was one or the other. And we'd have a few of those every day. And he didn't get that hit. Yeah. It wasn't good.
There's a lovely celebration in the year 2000, the This Is Your Life show, and Michael Aspel still presenting at that stage.
Yes.
And he's talking to you, and you talk about starting out with very little. This is the days of you just moved away. You were working in a factory, were you?
When I was there, yeah. Yeah, I worked in, yes. All sorts, collecting things. You get a list of things and you put them into a box, a bit like you probably do in Amazon, I suppose. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I worked all sorts, yeah.
So this is what you're doing. But of course, there's a trip to Monaco because obviously he's involved in racing. And were you living a life of glamour then?
People probably would have thought so, but we were in a caravan with no running water. Yeah. God, I can't remember how we got our water. And also I remember we were going to the ball in Monaco and I didn't have money to buy a gown, so I bought something in a second-hand shop back then and wore that. But I was delighted with myself because, you know, so much to see and glamour and, you know, it was like being a fly on the wall. It was great. But we did, that came about from when Eddie was racing there. He had his own sponsors. They sponsored him personally and paid him personally.
Yeah.
And then we had a child at that stage, so we were definitely on the breadline. And he used to actually pay for food locally with Marlboro cigarettes. So our local little village shop in Silverstone used to take in the cigarettes against food. And so eventually he put somebody else in his car. So he like did a rent a race.
Wow.
And we raced, and we traveled around the different racetracks in a caravan and went kind of from one end of Marlboro, in fact, up to Holland. We had one trip because when we were in Monaco, somebody had basically rented a race for the day or a race for the weekend in Holland, and we went up there. And eventually then he got more full-time people. And so that was how the team actually started. It was quite an easy kind of way to go about it.
But your life is incredible because just those stories in the book about getting F3 managers to do some babysitting for you, using the on-the-beach showers to get by. I mean, considering
that's
where
how we went to the ball.
That's
how glamorous it was. We literally had cold showers on the beach. I mean, we had the drivers living with us as well. And Zoe, the eldest, would have been about 8 months that time. And yes, it was the chap next door in the caravan babysat. She would have been asleep anyway, but he babysat for her. And strange times. In fact, one mechanic called Maui, and he used to sleep under the caravan.
Go away.
Well, he was probably from that type of, he was New Zealander, wasn't he? Yeah.
It sounds kind of almost circus-like, the kind of atmosphere of going from track to track. It really was.
I mean, it was quite easy. It was quite fun. You end up in a different village or town or city or whatever, and you kind of make your way around the area and get used to it. And yeah, your home is on your back, basically.
Monaco becomes very special to both of you, doesn't it? And the prince there, the man in charge, Prince Albert of Monaco.
Yes. Yeah. We have a lovely time there and lovely place to live. Lots of sun and it's very nice.
You didn't have to stay in the caravan forever, thankfully.
No, we've moved on a bit from there.
You did. But it was also Eddie rang his mum every day.
Yes, he did. I mean, they were extremely alike. She was the same, you know. Eddie dealt with a lot of businessmen and kind of shop owners. And when they saw her come, they'd all cringe because they knew she was looking for, she was going to look for a deal. There was no doubt she was coming in looking for a deal and she'd beat them down. And but she was good fun. Yeah, very lively. As I say, quite similar. I said the other day, if you put Eddie in a dress, you had Eileen. You
know, is that right?
They were like clones, yeah.
Everyone talks, and we're getting lovely messages, people bumping into Eddie all around the world in various places, and he always stops and has a chat, particularly for Irish people. One of the things that kept him humble, obviously, is you. We can tell from already just speaking to you this short time. And he'd also humbled friends as well, didn't he? Liam Cunningham, the actor, campaigner, very close friends he kept.
Yes. I mean, what we noticed after he died, with all the outpourings that he got in the papers and the TV, that he touched a lot of people's lives. And when he spoke to them, they felt special, I think. They felt something. And we also had about 50 of his number one best friends. Everybody, you know, yeah, they all thought that they were his best friend and his kind of major one. And the other thing we realized big time, I said to the family, I think the morning after he died, I said, oh yeah, we shared him. We absolutely shared him, because obviously if all those people were spending time, and I've got financial people and say, you know, people saying to me now, I spoke to Eddie during the day more than I spoke to any member of my family. So yeah, he was definitely on. I think he was on his phone probably 6 hours a day.
Go away! Wow. Mm. Seamus in Killarney says he met Eddie at the Breeders' Cup in New York 2001. It was just a few weeks after 9/11. Laterally, then used to run into him on his regular morning Nice to Monaco cycles. He always had time for chat. He's greatly missed in so many spheres. That's Seamus in Killarney. Another one says Eddie Jordan met him in Iran in November 2001 for the World Cup playoff. What a gentleman.
Yes.
What a huge supporter of the Irish national team. And that's from George.
Mm-hmm.
He always followed Irish sport, no matter what code it was.
Yeah. Just any sport, really. I mean, he'd watch the biking, all the different tours. We love the rugby and football as well, but yeah, maybe not quite so much. They don't do as well, so they're not usually on the major circuits. I loved any sport. I loved all music. In fact, I say if he was coming back for a second life, he would definitely be a rock star. He loved being on the stage, he loved playing the drums, just loved the whole scene going on there, and read all the books about all the lead singers and the different groups and all that kind of thing. But he also read all the sports ones as well. He loved the golf as well. We both played golf for quite some time.
You wonder where he fitted it all in. Another one says, I worked in Digifone, that's the Jordan sponsor. He opened the Digifone shop in Grafton Street in Dublin, 1996, and he signed a champagne cork for my son, Niall. Eddie laughed about it, said it was the first time he'd ever signed a cork.
I'm sure he signed worse since then, probably.
He was a fit man up until, as you say, the end. And Liam Cunningham tells a story about being in the gym. And Liam Cunningham is a big, strong actor. And Eddie drops and does 30 push-ups. And he's in his 70s at that point.
Oh, he could do 50 or 60, I think. Wow. Yeah, easily. That was his big. He loved to challenge somebody. And they'd all look at him and think, no way, no way. And next minute he'd be down on the floor, restaurants, on the pavement, didn't matter. He'd be down doing his push-ups, and yes, they'd be all. Yeah, he kept very fit, actually. And once again, you had that kind of, you know, if he was doing something like, he never went for an easy bike ride. He'd never kind of ease himself back into it. It was straight off into 50K kind of thing. And then you'd wonder why his legs were feeling a bit wobbly.
Go away. Marie, when it came to the end, did you get to say goodbye? Was it a nice, peaceful farewell from the family?
Not really, because he went quite quickly in the end, and then they had to sedate him. He ended up getting pneumonia and then kidney failure, and that all happened really within 2 days. So I don't think he would have wanted the big goodbyes. I think he was, and I also don't think he realized he was going until about the last probably maybe 8 or 10 days, I think it began to hit in. So until then, I think we thought to some degree, there were so many different things out there to do. And he used a new product called Lutetium, which looks absolutely fantastic. And we were trying to get him, there was an even newer one to use called Artetium, and we're waiting to use that. And goes for the cancer as opposed to the body. So it's a much, much easier on the body. And we really thought that he would survive with that. And unfortunately got the pneumonia before they could give it. And it happened quite quickly in the end.
For a man exploding with so much life, did he reckon with it? Was he able to be at peace with it?
Yeah, he seemed, I think he was on so many drugs at that stage, that a lot of morphine. But yes, I think he was at peace. And I think the morphine helped for sure.
Yeah, all that love that we hear from all around the world and at the time, I hope that was of some comfort.
It was fantastic. Yeah, it gave us something really good to aim at the next day. It was my daughter. The kids had taken kind of weeks off to come over, and she was over in Cape Town at the time, and she was with me. And we were able to spend the day just looking at the stuff. It was amazing.
Yeah,
and in some ways, we thought he'd been forgotten to some degree, because things had gone quiet for him. Yeah, you know, Cape Town is fairly, because they're not that motor racing involved, so you know, it's quite low key from there. Although people know him eventually, because then you know he kind of makes sure that
talks to everyone.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, things had gone quiet, and we were living in very normal kind of life together, and whatever. And to see all that, I mean, he'd have been thrilled, beyond thrilled with all the love that poured out.
Oh dear. And how are you keeping?
I'm pretty good now, heading back over to Cape Town now. I've taken up photography, which would be a great asset for me, because you can go off on your own with different groups and that kind of thing. So I'm looking forward. I'm heading off to Botswana fairly shortly.
Beautiful. God, you're in a beautiful part of the world for someone into photography.
Yeah, well, that's why I think I'm probably there. We were, when we went around the world, we kind of ended up there for Christmas. And I kind of went, you know, we're walking around thinking, oh, I said, I really like this. It's got a lovely vibe. It's young and fresh. And well, that's, you know, the sea is, as you know, probably extremely cold. So even though it's 30 degrees, the air temperature is cool.
Well, listen, enjoy every bit of that. Thanks so much for the chat.
Thank you, Oliver. That was lovely to talk to you.
We should, you and the family well. The biography is great fun. Full Throttle. Eddie Jordan, Full Throttle, by Keith O'Loughlin. Marie Jordan, thanks a million. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Email oliver@rte.ie.